My name is Richard Miller. I teach in philosophy, and I'm director of the program on ethics and public life. Our speaker today will discuss a great country in which the growth of inequality has been stupendous, and inequality is severe. The bottom 20% have about 5% of income. The top 10% have more than 30% of income, and there are intense discussions of whether government is sufficiently responsive to people's needs and desires. So far, what I have said would precisely fit the United States, but it precisely fits China as well. Our speaker, Wang Xiaoguang, is going to discuss inequality and economic governability, economic vulnerability in China, a country where there are differences as well that he will richly describe. Inequality is obviously different in a country where about a third still earn less than $2 a day. Responsiveness is a different question. In a country in which the vast, vast majority tell pollsters that they are satisfied with the way things are going. Wang Xiaoguang is professor and chair in the Department of Government and Public Administration at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and a professor at Tsinghua University in Beijing. He is the author of pioneering studies going decades back of the growth of inequality in China and the persistence of poverty in China. But his eminence isn't just as someone who studies these hard facts. He is also an influential advocate of policies for making life better for the worst off, including in such basic ways in healthcare, and engaging with such familiar topics of controversy in the United States as taxation. He is also a source of highly innovative insights into the nature of the political process in China and its relation to democratic values. Someone who has done so much to improve the lives of a fifth of humanity would, just by that token, be a benefactor of humanity as a whole. But in addition, because of these parallels and because of his creativity, Wang Xiaoguang sheds bright light on the parallel questions of equity and democracy that occupy people in the United States. I'd like to think that an important source of this transnational illumination is part of Wang Xiaoguang's personal history. He received his PhD in government in 1990 from the Government Department at Cornell. Wang Xiaoguang's talk will be on the theme toward a more secure and more equal society, public policy reorientation in China.
Thank you, Professor Miller. Also, I'd like to thank everyone. I stay in Ithaca for 8 years. I know how nice today the weather is. If I were you, I would rather enjoy the good weather outside rather than attending a boring lecture here. So thank you. I change the subtitle a little bit from the policy reorientation into the emergence of a social policy in China. Here is what I'm going to do today. Carl Polanyi, I first come to this name when I was graduate student here at Cornell, 1982-83. Number of courses I attend, a science book as kind of required reading. So that's how I got familiar with Carl Polanyi's book, The Great Transformation. And since then, I mean, almost 30 years ago, I have opportunities to read the book over and over again. I think now I have a better understanding of what Carl Polanyi is trying to say. So first of all, I found his perspective is very useful for understanding the change taking place in China in the recent decades. That's why basically, there are two parts of my talk, a very simple exercise. First, highlight Polanyi's the key points. Then I will use his approach to analyze what happened in China. I think most people here are very familiar with Karl Polanyi's thesis, moral economy, great transformation, and self-adjusting market as kind of a utopia, and then the double movement. Let me just highlight some points. In his view, the economic system as a rule are embedded in social relations. Distribution of material goods is ensured by non-economic motives, not just maximize utility for the individual, rather to some non-economic motive. And in his view, the old economic system, knowing to us up to the end of the feudalism in West Europe, were organized either on the principle of the reciprocity or redistribution or householding, namely the production for one's own consumption, or some combination of three. So in his view, this is the human society in the history, the situation, the moral economy. However, in the recent time, I mean in the last 200 years, there's something else come up. It's kind of a self-regulating market. This is something new all the way up to the end of the 18th century, according to Polanyi. So through, in his view, although the institution of market was fairly common long, long time ago, but it is no, they are not important. It's only incidental to the economic life of the human being. So the change from the regulated to self-regulating market, in his view, at the end of the 18th century, represent a complete transformation in the structure of a society. That's why the book titled Great Transformation. However, it's important to realize a self-regulating market economy can function only in a market society. But this kind of a society is very different from the old one. The market society is a kind of a society where instead of an economy being embedded in social relations, now the social relations are embedded in the economic system. This kind of a system, in his view, is a kind of a utopia. This kind of institution cannot exist for any length of time, in his view, because otherwise, if it stays for long, it's going to destroy the human being and the nature substance of society. Then he talked about his observation of a double movement. In his word, for a century, the dynamics of a modern society was governed by a double movement. The market expanded continuously, but this movement was met by a counter movement, checking the expansion in definite direction. So very simple nowadays, I think many people now know his point. Moral economy, great transformation, self-adjusting market as utopian, and a double movement. How Karl Polanyi's perspective is useful for understanding China, this is what I'm going to do next. My argument is very simple. China has also undergone a great transformation over the last six decades, which also consists of the double movement. On the one hand, you have a kind of a politically induced transformation from moral economy to market system. But on the other hand, sooner or later, this kind of counter movement emerged to protect the society and the nature. In my view, the Chinese modern, the PRC history can be broke into three sub-periods. The first period from 1949, when PRC was founded, to 1984, I didn't use 1978. People normally use 1978 as a kind of a watershed year. Rather, I used 1984 because a great deal of things didn't change all the way up to 1984-85. I would say this is a period, you may call it a kind of a moral economy, socialist planned moral economy. In this period, there's simply no need for social policy. Second period, from around 1985 to 1998, we see a kind of a movement politically induced toward to the market society with little or almost no intention, attention to social policy. If anything, we observe anti-social policy during this period. The third period starts around 1999, all the way up to now. So this is the period which we began to observe emergence of social policy. Here, the cutoff year obviously arbitrarily chosen. So it's just around this particular year, not precisely something dramatic happened in that particular year. This is just for the convenience of analysis. Let me first talk about the first period, the period of moral economy. During this period, market play little or no vital role in the human social life in China at the time. And securing human livelihood was submerged in and determined by the nucleus of non-economic institutions, such as work unit, 工作单位, and the people's commune, 人民公社, and by institutionalized norm, such as security, equality, solidarity. In my view, the economy at the time was embedded in society mainly through two mechanisms. Those two mechanisms may be familiar to many of you. One is a self-budget constraint, 软预算约束. Another one is Aaron Rice-Bohm, 铁饭碗. Let me illustrate how this system works. So individuals, in the city, they're all somehow covered by some kind of a work unit. In the countryside, it's going to be team, production team, brigade, or people's commune. So in any case, it's kind of a unit. The people interact with the unit, not directly with the government as such. And the unit relationship between unit and the individual is guaranteed by 铁饭碗 or air rice bone. So it's a kind of a lifetime employment, and you cannot break it up. You cannot change one from one unit to another. I was a school teacher during this period. Because my school is very far away from my home, I want to change in the work unit, but it's very hard. I worked 5 years, struggled for 5 years, and never got a chance to change it. So it's both positive and negative for the human life. The relationship between the work unit and the local government, local budget, is something called the self-budget constraint. So you submit all the revenue to the government, and the government cover the expenditure, even if you are money-losing unit, then self-budget constraint. Central government, local government, again, is some kind of a self-budget constraint. Self-budget constraint and Aaron Rice-Bohm, after economic reform, has been under criticism severely. But this is a system somehow ensure the human livelihood in China. Let me use the example of healthcare. Okay, this is the how healthcare system worked in urban China. On one side, you have a GIS. This is mostly for government employees. Another side is LIS, Laobao, is mostly for factory workers. So this enterprise or government agency provide healthcare services to employees and their families. And the government budget also provides the fund for healthcare providers. This is how the healthcare system works during this period. in urban China. In rural China, there's three things. One is called cooperative medicine system or scheme, 合作医疗. This kind of scheme deals with the financing of healthcare. The second component is 赤脚医生, barefoot doctor. This provide the service of healthcare. Then another important component is low tech rather than high tech. There's a slogan at the time called 一根针一把草. So acupuncture and Chinese medicine are used because they are low cost. So to reduce the cost of healthcare. This shows the percentage of village in China with the cooperative medicine scheme operation in China. You see, by the end of the Cultural Revolution, 1976, about 93% of a village covered by this kind of the scheme. I have to say that scheme of the cooperative medicine in different village are very different. Okay, they are independent to each other. The skin, the main feature are the same, but the details are very different. Nevertheless, by end of the Cultural Revolution, most of the village were covered by this kind of a rural healthcare system. So in urban China and rural China, near everyone is covered, even though the coverage and the benefits are very different from union from unit and village from village. The system works fine, I mean, during the period. We can use the two indicators. One is the infant mortality rate. In 1949, the people estimate the death rate of a baby is about 200 per thousand or 250 per thousand. Very high mortality rate. And then by 1974, down to 47 per thousand, then 81, 35 per thousand. Another is a life expectancy. When China and the PRC was founded, the people estimate the life expectancy was around 35 years old. And by time of 1974, 1982, we see the average life expectancy increased to 68 years old. So people's life become much, much more secure than before under this kind of a system. If we talk about the equality or inequality, China at that time was perhaps too equal. The first thing happened after the Cultural Revolution, just before economic reform to start, was a criticism of equality, too equal. So this is an estimation of the Gini coefficient in rural China, urban China, and China as a whole, with or without adjustment for cost of living differences. You can see the Gini coefficient was pretty low. China was quite equal. So it was equal and secure. I use the HDI, Human Development Index, comparing China and India for 3 years, 1950, 1975, and 1980. This is mostly during this period. You can see in 1950, China, India are more or less the same in terms of HDI. Then in 1975, there's differences. 1980, huge differences. But China was still poor, still poor. Here I use a medicine's data set of the per capita GDP. You can compare in India and China again. In 1950, per capita GDP in India was much higher than China's. And over the years, all the way up to 1978, only in 1978, China began to overtake India in terms of per capita GDP. India was poor, China was even poorer. So for most of the time during this period. It's poor, but life becomes secure and equal. That's kind of underrated. Here is what Amartya Sen said about this period. He said China's relative advantage over India, here specifically referred to the quality of labor and the social structure. He said relative advantage of China over India is a product of its pre-reform groundwork rather than its post-reform redirection. That's in the first period. The second period starts around 1984-85, in any case, middle of the 1980s. Before 1984, China already see market, free market for consumer goods, agricultural produce, and so on. But the market was still very marginal in the overall economy and often very heavily regulated. Before 1984. Only after 1984-85, especially after 1986, we began to see a development of a market system rather than the market. Here, market system including not only the market for product, but also the factor market, including labor and the finance. 1986, for instance, China changed the employment from the lifelong employment to contract. So from 1984 to 1992, we see the development of market system. Then from 1993 to 1999, in my view, China began to see the development of a market society. Market threatened to become the dominant mechanism integrating the entire society. Not only in economic affairs, but societal affairs, even in terms of government. This is the period when government encouraged government employee and government agencies to make money. Government even encouraged the military police to make money because budget simply cannot cover their operational costs. The PLA, the People's Liberation Army, was only given about 60% what they need, the PLA needs. So 40% has to come out from some kind of market operation. So very strange society at the time. And during this period, this is the kind of a hero in China, Hayek. Almost all the book, important book of Hayek, been translated into Chinese. And another hero is Milton Friedman. The photo here is the Milton Friedman meet with the Chinese Prime Minister Zhao Ziyang in 1988. Another one is he came to China again 1993 to meet the President Jiang Zemin. So this is, of course, you may say this is just isolated happening, but I think it's quite symbolically important. Later we'll see different person becoming important in China. During the second period, the first structure of the unit-based welfare began to break up. The relationship between unit and the individual now connect by contract. There's no lifetime guarantee employment anymore. So people can be laid off one way or another. Relationship between unit and the local government become hard budget constraint. If the one unit didn't make money, it can go under. The first bankruptcy case take place around this time, 1984-85 in Shenyang City. And then more bankruptcy happened in 1996 to 2002. So with this kind of a system, new system, contract, hard budget constraint, eating in separate kitchen. I mean, the different provinces eating in separate kitchen. In this kind of new system, the people began to suffer. If your unit is still making money, therefore you still have all kinds of a benefit entitlement. But if you are not lucky enough your unit is losing money or go bankrupt, then you lose all the benefit, even though you are still state-owned enterprise employee. Many key services for people's life become commodified, including healthcare, education, environment, and so on and so forth. The economy become disembedded from the social relations, from a kind of ethical concern. Consequently, workers and the farmers were forced to get by with reduced entitlement to assistance and security to live with a growing inequality. Let me take healthcare again as an example. Here is a structure of overall health expenditure in China. Okay, basically there are three components. One is the public finance out of government budget. Second is social insurance. The third part is out of pocket from individuals. You see, before middle of the 1980s, the proportion of out-of-pocket payment was rather small. Lowest point in 1986 is only 26%. But by year 2001, it increased to 60%. Putting this 60% in comparative perspective, WHO published a report about 10 years ago saying that China ranked bottom four, I mean, over 188 countries, China, the out-of-pocket proportion is highest, the bottom four, okay? So the people have to use the money to see doctor, to buy medicine, mostly on themselves. This is just what happened in urban area. All those numbers are not important. What is important is here. 1993, in urban China, about 27.6% of the population, urban population, was not covered by some kind of insurance. In 1998 survey, it increased to 47.4%. 2003, 50%. So the people without any health insurance coverage doubled in about 10 years. And this, the proportion, China conduct this kind of a nationwide survey first in 1993. We don't know the situation before. Situation before, and the proportion of people without any coverage should be much lower, all right? So in urban China, by 2003, half of the population have no insurance. In countryside, the cooperative medicine scheme used to work in China, solve the security problem. Now, simply gone, okay? So 1996, almost 93%. By year 2000, it's barely 6%. So in much of the countryside, people simply have no insurance whatsoever. Only in 6% of the village, there's some kind of the old remnants of the cooperative medical scheme still work. As a result, many people simply cannot afford to see doctor, all right? And if you are unfortunately, you and your family member have a serious illness or disability, then you're in big trouble. This is again the survey. To what extent the illness and the disability is a cause of poverty, comparing 2 years, 1998 and 2003. By 2003, we see huge percentage of the people living in poverty was only because one of the family member was in serious health condition, all right? That's about security. In terms of income inequality, this, I think, illustrates very clearly. Before 2002, 2003, you can see no matter how you measure and which part of China you measure, the degree of inequality simply deteriorate, worsen, okay? It all increase. That's the period when I concentrate on my research concentrate on inequality. I and my colleagues in at Tsinghua have published a number of books and articles on inequality. In this period, in the second period, the only thing I think nice is the reduction of poverty. By Chinese official poverty definition, the people living under poverty decreased dramatically from 1978 to now. I mean, in the second period, decreased dramatically. By international standard, China was also doing very well in terms of poverty reduction because according to World Bank, between 1981 to 2004, in China, 0.5 billion people get out of poverty by World Bank standards. In entire developing world, 0.5 billion. So in other words, but for China, there would have been no decline in number of poor in developing world over the last two decades of the 20th century. So China was doing well in this respect. But China become more insecure, security become a problem, and equality become a problem. Now in the third period. As Carl Polanyi points out, the market liberalism make demands on ordinary people that was simply not bearable. So the pyramid goal of the counter movement emerged in the last 10 years or so is to redistribute resources so as to protect society through reducing human insecurity and income inequality. Now the hero is different. Is Joseph Stiglitz. This is a picture of Joseph Stiglitz with China's Prime Minister Wen Jiabao. And Carl Polanyi. I first brought Carl Polanyi's book, Great Transformation, back to China in 1984. I said, this book is very interesting, very influential in the Western academic world. I recommend it to my friends, saying this is worth of translating into Chinese. Nobody paid any attention to the book. 1986, I went back to China again with this book. Again, nobody paid attention. The Chinese version didn't come up until 2007. So this is in the first simplified Chinese edition published by Zhejiang Renmin Chubanshe, 2007. And this you may not recognizable. If you use the Google, you found now there are 1.7 million items somehow related with Carl Polanyi in China. If you search Carl Polanyi a few years back, the total turnout would be much, much smaller. So we see enormous interest in Carl Polanyi in recent time. Then in the third period, the unit-based welfare already gone, not workable in a new situation. So this is something new that most people familiar with. On the one hand, the people pay taxes to the state. On the other hand, state become responsible for social assistance, social insurance, and provide the basic social services. And since year 1999, we began to see many new social policies, starting with the so-called Go West program. The government used the intergovernmental transfer to help the poor Western provinces to develop its economy. In 1999, I was interviewed by some Chinese reporters because we have published three books on regional disparities. They asked, with this kind of a Go West program, how long it take for China to reduce regional disparities? At that time, I said, perhaps it take 30 to 50 years to reduce the regional disparities. Then we have many new programs come out For instance, in 2002, China began to introduce the DBIO, the Urban Minimum Income Guarantee Program, and then there are many new programs. The latest is comprehensive healthcare reform, more inclusive housing policy, old pension, old age pension program for all, not only the employee in urban area, but also the rural resident and the not employed people in urban China as well. Social programs are very expensive. China didn't spend much money in social protection before, in the past. Here I use the ILO report 2001. In this report, comparing China 2006 with the country, about 100 countries, here I only highlight some region and some key countries. 2006, China spent less proportionally smaller than world average on social protection, all right? But you can see the China 2010 and the China 2011. By 2011, the expenditure on social protection already surpassed the world average, not in America, Middle East. So it's increased very quickly in the last few years. And basically, the new social policies aim at two things. One is to reduce human insecurity. Another is to reduce the income inequality. Let me just highlight some area. First, healthcare again. Healthcare, as I said before, in 2001, 60% of expenditure, overall expenditure of healthcare come out from individual, out-of-pocket payment, all right? But since then, the proportion of out-of-pocket payment declined dramatically. By 2011, down to 35.5%, and the government aiming at below 30% in a few years. So in a few years, I'm pretty sure this is going to happen. In a few years, 70% will be covered either by public finance or social insurance, 30% may be kind of a co-payment and so on, so that people will become more secure. In urban China, this is the number of population covered by some kind of health care insurance. In urban China now, close to 500 million people, about 5 billion in urban China. In rural China, by 2011, it's about 832 million people covered, and this year it's going down to 230 because the proportion of the rural resident has been declining, all right? If you add the two together, so in China, about 96% of the people covered by health insurance program one way or another, all right? Just in a few years, you compare the situation of 2003, only 15% of people covered, but now 96% of people covered by health insurance. In addition to health insurance, some people cannot pay the premium, all right? So the government provides the medical assistance to help them to join, to pay the premium of the healthcare insurance. Now, this shows the minimum income scheme first introduced 2001, 2002, and then stabilized at about, in the city, about 20 million people covered by minimum income guarantee scheme, and then later, many rural residents began to enjoy this program, even though the benefit is very small in size, but the number of people covered has been increasing. Now close to over 80 million people benefit from this program. In terms of pension, you can see the urban basic pension coverage and the rural basic pension coverage. So used to be very low. Only urban residents were covered by some kind of a pension program, but now it extend to the rural area, especially in the last few years. Government made a pledge to cover everyone in the coming years in terms of pension. There are some another type of social insurances, include unemployment insurance, work injury insurance, and maternity insurance. So all of those have been increasing in the recent years. The latest development is about housing. Housing is a serious problem in China. Everyone talk about it as how expensive the housing become. Here, only give an average, the floor space for urban and rural resident. In terms of average, you can see the housing situation have been improved, but there's still the people with low income or middle income simply cannot afford the commercial housing. Therefore, in the recent years, the government began to introduce the social housing, idea of social housing. So including the public rent, 公租房 housing, no rent, 廉租房 housing, and affordable housing, 经济适用房, the different scheme. And this is what happening in the recent years in terms of the social housing, how many units start and how many units complete each year. Most dramatic change, of course, is in the last couple years. In 2010, more than 5 million units were start to build, all right? In 2011, government required 10 million units or start to build. So in the coming years, the more units will become completed. So in several years, China will build perhaps 40 million units of public social housing. If you average size of a family is 3, 40 million times 3, we're talking about 120 million people. So ultimately, the government want to cover using some kind of social housing to cover 20% of the population in China. That's reducing the human insecurity. The development in terms of reducing income inequality, this is some new development as well. This is about the regional disparities. Here I quote a Japanese scholar. He recalculated the regional disparity in by using different kind of indicators. This is using the coefficient of variation to measure the interprovincial differences. If most of the research use the 户籍人口, okay, the people with the urban or rural household registration, but this scholar suggests it's better to use 常住人口, the concept. So when you use the 常住人口 concept to measure the interprovincial disparities, you see the change began in 2003, 2004. So the degree of the interprovincial disparity actually declined dramatically in the recent years. Even you use a different measure, if you use the Gini index instead, the pattern is more or less the same. Since 2003, 2004, we began to see the narrowing of the regional gap rather than expanding. So I was too pessimistic in 1999. At that time, I suggested it take 30 to 50 years for China to narrow the gap, but now it's already happening. In terms of the gap between rural and urban, this shows, I think, quite nicely either measure gap of consumption or gap of income, you see gap began to narrow in the recent years. It's not no longer increase, okay? In the past, increase from middle of 1980s all the way to the recent years, but now in the last few years began narrowing. So rural-urban gap has not been growing in the recent years. If we talk about the inequality within the rural China, here I use the ratio of the top quintile to bottom quintile, the top 20%, bottom 20%. You can see the differences. In terms of income, the gap is, of course, it's pretty large, but it's more or less stay at this level, 7.5 times higher the top quintile than compared to the lower quintile. In terms of consumption, then it's down from 3.5 times high to 3.2% times high. This is the urban, again, using the same way of the measurement, the ratio of the top to bottom quintile in terms of income and the consumption. We can see the gap is not growing anymore. Is more or less narrowing. So I would agree with this report. This is a report of OECD, the 2001 report, a 2010 report. In the report, it suggests the overall inequality has ceased to increase in recent year, and it may even have inched down. This is also my observation. I have tried to calculate regional disparities. I agree with this observation. So to conclude, in my observation, for the first time in China's history, we have observed the emergence of a social policy only in the recent years. Currently, the government has both political will and the physical capacity to reduce human insecurity and income inequality. However, there's still big room for improvement on both fronts. I in the last part of my talk, I mostly talk about nice things happening, but I have to point out the gap is still large, even though it's narrowing, it's remain more or less in the same level, the gap is too large, should be further reduced. Especially urban-rural gap is pretty large, larger than perhaps any country in the world. In terms of a social protection, all kinds of insurance, the level is rather low. For example, the pension for rural residents is very low. It's only 65 yuan in some part of China per month, which is very extremely low. I expect the level will increase, but nevertheless, current level is very low. So there's still big room for improvement in terms of the government political will as well as the physical capacity to change. Nevertheless, the emergence of social policy mark a historical turning point, in my view, a kind of a perennial counter movement. That's my conclusion. Thank you. Sure.
Thank you for a fascinating lecture, Professor Wang. I have two questions. One,
Okay, let me answer the second part of the question first. In the past, not our program only covered urban resident. But recently, the program began to extend to cover all residents, whether it's urban or migrant or non-employed people. So for instance, the pension and the health insurance now began to cover the migrant. So this is kind of a new development. In some places, housing benefit extend to the migrant workers. For instance, in Chongqing, their public housing, social housing, now everyone can apply. They draw random selection, join the winner. I mean, in Chongqing, they plan to build 40 million square meter in 3 years, so to solve a notable problem for many people. In terms of whether it has, to what extent the social mobilization play a role in terms of counter movement, I would say perhaps it's very important, but not necessarily in the same way as elsewhere. For instance, why all of a sudden in 2002, the government began to introduce the minimum income guarantee scheme? I would say perhaps not of a strike taking place around 2000, contribute to this kind of a new development. And there's a cry for more extensive health insurance reform or pension reform or housing reform on the internet. And remember, the internet user first crossed the bar of the 20 million in 2002. And much of the change also happening after 2002. I don't think that's kind of accidental. Perhaps there's some relationship. Of course, I cannot prove this, but this is just my observation. I think those two developments are somehow linked.
Your predictions for the next 10 years?
For what?
Anything that you have confidence in related to increased social policy?
I think in terms of social policy, they are going to extend to everyone. And the protection level will be higher. For instance, let me show this. Poverty. You see, in 2011, the people living under poverty actually increased. The main reason is very simple. Official poverty line almost doubled within 1 year. All right. So in the past, the poverty line is just about 500 yuan per year. Now increased to more than close to 2,500 a year. So that's how number of people living in poverty actually increase. In terms of the contribution to the government, the public finance contribution to individual health care benefit. When the government began to introduce the new cooperative medicine scheme in 2003, government only contributed 20 yuan per head per year. Now it's over 200 yuan per year. So within about 10 years, increased 10 times. So this kind of a trend I think would continue. Cannot be stopped. The social protection, I think, is something we can only go forward rather than go backward. When people benefit those things, they are not going to easily give up. So it can only be improving rather than declining.
Much has been made of the one child policy and an inverted pyramid with demographic
Frankly, I have no answer. I'm not expert on the demography, so I cannot make the prediction. But I think now in China, quite a number of scholars advocate relaxing the one-child policy because in urban China, and the willingness to have more children has down to is already decreased dramatically anyway. Even in some part of rural China, they don't want to have more children. So this is a very quick change in China. But how that's going to affect the inequality, I simply don't know. Okay, Bo Xilai, okay. In the recent years, I went to Chongqing very frequently. In several occasions, I met him in person. I also happened to be in the same department as Gu Kailai, his wife, with just 1 year difference. I was class 77, she was 78. So I knew the girl, but of course now it's an old lady. I still cannot believe she is involved in murder. I simply cannot imagine that could happen. I have a lot of doubt about the accusation against her. I care much less about their personal fate than what has happened in Chongqing. I think what has happened in Chongqing in the recent years, in my view, very positive. You simply go to Chongqing, ask the people on the street, randomly. I will say, if you ask 10 people, 9 people will tell you what happened in Chongqing was very positive to their benefit. They themselves also have doubt about an official accusation against the couple. So that's my observation.
Justin Lin left to catch his plane after his talk. He does this get worked out, and how do these processes of intention, how do you think they'll change in the years to come? Will there be institutionalization that means this disorder is less important? Big question, but you're a good one.
Okay. I somewhat anticipated the question. What are the experimental variables? I will point out the three. The first one, I don't think we should underestimate the socialist legacy. I said this very simple. In 1993, 1994, the government already realized the government have to cover health insurance for everyone. In fact, back to 1986, the government made a pitch to WHO to provide affordable health care to everyone by year 2000. But at that time, there's a kind of a willingness, but there's no money. No money. So on the second variable, the state capacity to cover was very low. Here is the situation of public finance in China, all right? Revenue as a percentage of GDP, expenditure as a percentage of GDP. Then I calculated something I called gross physical revenue as a percentage of GDP and the gross physical expenditure as a percentage of GDP. If you only look at the official budget, then this is the middle of the 1990s. This is the time government admit it has obligation to cover health care and other social services. But this is simply no money. The government budget only accounts for about 10% of GDP. And the central government share of 10% of GDP is only about 4% of GDP. At least 1% of GDP has to go to national defense. And another 1% has to cover public employee, their payment, right? So there's simply no money for the government to do anything, even though government knew they have obligation to cover social, key social services for human security. So without the improvement of public finance in recent years, in the last 15 years or so, government simply couldn't do anything. Only in the last few years, the government is capable of raise more taxes and changing the tax structure so that every level of government have an incentive to take to collect taxes so that they can cover. So there's a second variable. The capacity to do things is very important. The most difficult part is about willingness. One part of the answer, of course, is what I pointed out earlier, socialist legacy. When government claim as a socialist country is supposed to take care of everyone, they knew people have that kind of expectation. So that explains a little bit of what willingness of on the part of a government. Another important part, I think, has to do with I have an article titled "Change Model for Agenda Setting in Policy Making." In the past, agenda setting mostly decide in the inner circle, either among policymaker or among the policy advisors. But in the recent years, we observe the extension of a policy circle in China. So everyone become part of the policy process, in a sense. So if you trace the compliances, grievances expressed on internet, then 2-3 years, those issues become the policy making, items for policy making. So I would say public opinion now play very important role in the policymaking process. That explains another part of the willingness. So opinion expressed on internet, I think it's very, very powerful. okay, force will persuade the government to do things, and otherwise they may not have the pressure to do. So that's my very simple explanation. I don't know whether you are satisfied. Yeah, we met in 1982, Wharton Library.
I wonder if you could elucidate a little more on what you liked about Bo Xilai's work, Chongqing, because he has been ripped apart in the Western press, who of course love reformers and don't like people. And I'd also like to point out that Chao Shur, 15 years ago, suffered a worse fate, and the Western press hardly said anything about Chao Shur falling.
Yeah, I think the people outside of Chongqing only pay attention to two things. One is called Changhong, sailing the red. Another is Dahei, the repressed the gangsters. But in my view, what happened in Chongqing is more extensive. If you had a chance to visit Chongqing just a few months ago, even 1 month ago, you see a lot of signs talking about five Chongqings, including, for instance, accessible Chongqing, livable Chongqing, healthy Chongqing, safe Chongqing. So those issues are more important. The government spent, Chongqing municipal government, not Bo Xilai himself, but the municipal government as a whole, had to spend enormous energy of doing that. Just one example. You go to Chongqing in the last, if last few months, everywhere you see a kind of a mobile car there, provide the opportunity for everyone to change your hukou from rural to urban without any condition. So within 1 year, more than 3 million people change their household registration from rural to urban without any condition. Elsewhere in China, if you want to change your hukou, household registration, you have to give up your land back home. In Chongqing, they said, you don't need to do so within 5 years. You have 5 years to consider whether it's worthwhile of converting from rural to urban residence. If you regret, you can go back to the rural residence. If you like urban life, then later on you can somehow sell the land to the government. There's something called a di-piao system in Chongqing. So that's why people appreciate this kind of a policy innovation in Chongqing. I don't think that has not anything wrong. This should be continued in Chongqing or elsewhere.
Xiao Guang, thank you so much for this extremely informative and insightful description of one of extremely important aspects of China's development. This is exactly what I expect to hear from you. And given the kind of depths in and the kind of intellectual sense of what you have described, and as a historian, I would like to share with you some of my own puzzles and also some kind of sense of dilemmas in trying to link what you have discussed today to some larger issues that is possible. I would like to highlight two of them. The first one is about socialist legacy. In your description of socialist legacy, it's more about equality, but actually it's much broader. You mentioned that what has happened in China should be attributed to pre-reform groundwork. And that is not just infrastructure. This is also about society, about politics, about the people's sense of where they had been and who they had been and what they were. Or in other words, a kind of socialist citizenship had been created, which cannot be brought back to the pre-1949 era. I think that is extremely important. I would like to observation of the kind of contradiction and dilemma in the kind of sense of this socialist citizenship. And many observers, and including some so-called historians, accusation of that period at the worst in Chinese history as epitomized in such events like Grand Famine. So I think that's one of my puzzle and dilemma. And secondly, it's also related to your observation of Chongqing. Obviously, I agree with you. You know, we needed to pay attention to the details of Chongqing and what happened in Chongqing. And my worry actually is, if you compare Wen Jiabao's comments on Guo Xilai and the later announcement of the government, you find the folks have changed. Wen Jiabao's comments are really about the politics.
Right.
It's really about whether or not what happened in Chongqing, whether bringing Chongqing back to the Cultural Revolution years. I think that's important because, let me put it this way, we all suffered in the Cultural Revolution. But to say that the Cultural Revolution was nothing, it was just a completely a black hole, and therefore it should be erased, and anything about the Cultural Revolution, I'm not creating the Cultural Revolution. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that Cultural Revolution was not designed. I'm saying that Cultural Revolution was a social and political reality. Mm-hmm. And using, that's a debatable, that's important. And now to identify Guo Xilai and his wife as nobody but criminals, that's a completely different story because they're not defendable. So actually, that leads to a larger question, which is related to my earlier observation about the socialist legacy. Is it possible? Is it necessary in discussing these issues? Can we still have a kind of historical and intellectual reconsideration of both the socialist legacy and an impact on today and in the future, not just in terms of you know the specifics, but can that help us to come up with some kind of moral redefinition that will give China the kind of spiritual bone which will allow the process you know that had begun. I agree with you, it's not just 30 years, it's 60 years, or even longer, or 100 years, with a kind of reawakening of the nation. You know, I will say there's a moral crisis there, right? And how can this be, you know, addressed in the context of your speech? Because I cannot help but ask these questions to borrow from your huge intellectual power.
Right, actually you have three issues. The last one I think is about, you said it's a kind of a moral crisis. I wrote a paper a couple years ago. In the paper I argue, if we talk about what people valued, then there's no moral crisis. People have an enormous degree of agreement. What is right, what is wrong. I'm talking about public opinion survey. For instance, the more equal, the equality between all kind of classes, whether collectively is more important than individual, on those issues, there's an enormous degree of agreement. Perhaps we have observed what people believe and what people actually act. There's a kind of a discrepancies. In that sense, we may talk about the crisis, but in terms of what the people believe in, I didn't see much evidence of a crisis. Socialist legacy, when Amartya Sen talked about the groundwork done before economic reform, actually there are a number of things. Not only the quality of labor, much higher, I didn't show the slides about education. Most people didn't know that. In 1976, 77, 78, enrollment number was the highest in the PRC history. After economic reform, the enrollment of a high school, a junior high school, actually declined all the way to 2002, recovered the level of 1977, 1978. So education is another important contribution why the quality of labor was high in China compared to many developing countries. Social structure change related with the attitude to citizenship, that's also very important, cannot easily erase. This is connected with your question related with the cultural evolution. My dissertation at Cornell was about the cultural evolution. I remember when I did the field work in 1986, I interviewed many people who had been conservative during the Cultural Revolution. They suggest in 1986, if there were another Cultural Revolution, will become the rebel against authority. So they knew what they want, and they knew what they did before. So Cultural Revolution, if you talk about the victim of Cultural Revolution, no one can compare with the couple we just mentioned, Bo Xilai and Gu Kailai. I knew Gu Kailai during the Cultural Revolution worked for the street, 街道工厂. Okay? His family actually suffered even before the Cultural Revolution. So they are the victims of a Cultural Revolution. They have no desire whatsoever to bring China back to a Cultural Revolution, not to mention it's not possible to do so anyway. So I agree with you completely. There's a huge differences between Wen Jiabao's acquisition and the official acquisition announced last week. One is a political, now is a criminal. So I cannot explain why this changed. Okay? In a recent newspaper report editorial, we no longer see the Cultural Revolution rhetoric against Bo Xilai or Chongqing anymore. It's now become a criminal. I don't know why. I cannot answer this question. Yeah, I think a friend of mine, Huan Gang, just wrote a paper on the collective presidency in China. He characterized the Standing Committee of Power Bureau as a collective presidency of China. So in other words, Hu Jintao or whoever come after Hu Jintao is just one among equal of nine rather than one above equal. So there must be differences in opinion, just like in any university, any academic societies, association, there's huge differences in their view or preferences. So, but as a collective decision-making body, there's no another way than striking a kind of a balance. So despite the fact of a removal of Bo Xilai, I don't think anyone can dictate or turn the clock back to move China back to a market society. I would think it's going to move somewhat like a social market system. In other words, the social consideration become equally or perhaps more important than the consideration of efficiency, economic growth. You can see the evidence from official statement or official newspaper editorial. Now there's a fashionable to act, to criticize the PR, GDP, brand pursuing the high GDP. This year, government report lower the target of a growth rate from about 8% to 7%. I think that reflects this kind of a trend. So in the internal politics of the top 25, namely the power bureau, the top nine, I don't think any view will be dominate. There has to be some kind of a reconciliation of different view in the body. So that's my understanding of the politics here. No. I happen to talk a great deal about the happiness in the recent years. In China, there is an institution called the G Gross Happiness Index Research Center. I become some kind of unofficial consultant to that center, so I talk about a great deal about the happiness. When Guangdong provinces advocate Happy Guangdong, I also been part of the people involved in the discussion. A higher the income, a more happy the people, at least in China currently. All right. My basic argument is this: very simple. Unless people's basic needs are met somehow, people cannot be happy, all right? So that's why I think all of those change happened in recent year is important. Those not address the people's wants, what they want to have, rather is their basic needs for being a human being. So if those improvement continues, Chinese people will become happier. This is a very different from the view who believe material life is not important. But the Chinese people are not religious. Therefore, basic material foundation is still very important to improve people's happiness.
Thank you.
Actually, if you see the big picture, I think that change has already happened. Before 2008, seven coastal provinces account for perhaps 80-90% of export imports. In other words, most of the provinces didn't rely upon foreign trade at all, even before 2008. Now, it's those provinces, that didn't rely upon foreign trade, grow faster than coastal provinces. So Chongqing, for instance, has been growing at 16-17% a year for several years. So is Tianjin, so is Inner Mongolia, Hubei, and so on. Those inland provinces. The provinces rely upon foreign trade now suffer reduction of the growth rate. Shenzhen, for instance, in the recent months actually even become negative. So this shows the growth pattern has already changed. Okay, now the center of growth has shifted from coastal to inland provinces where trade not very important.